Hello there, ladies and gentlemen. The MSS crew is once again thanking you for joining us here in the Fred Bertelsen Memorial Old Time Radio Room of RadioOutOfThePast.org. Today's date is Saturday, August 6th, 2016. 8-6-16, look at that. I'm Luis Jr., the MSS host, and I am once again assisting with bringing to you an exciting and exhilarating internet broadcast of Michael's Saturday Night Surprise. Well, folks, we're back as promised, and tonight we have a special edition show, which will probably go a little bit longer than our normal broadcast hour, and it will just so happen to be brought to you by Mad Max Crawford. Of course, you know, he can't get enough of this stuff, so he had to pull an audible and set something up that I think each and every one of you are going to enjoy thoroughly. So without any further delays, I would just ask if everyone could please sit back, grab your favorite drinks and snacks, and enjoy the program. It's going to be a little bit of a long one. Mad Max, the microphone is yours.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Maxwell welcoming you to Michael's Saturday Surprise for Saturday, August the 6th, 2016. Our theme tonight is ships, disasters. Yes, ships, disasters, because there's two ships that will be having disasters tonight. And it's all, unfortunately, historical fact. This comes from the Myths and Legends series, which I find informative and educational. So, let's start. Our first program from the Myths and Legends series tonight is the Hindenburg disaster, which occurred in 1937. So let's start the program now.
The Hindenburg leaves her hangar in the spring of 1936. She was the ultimate airship and the pride of Nazi Germany. A leviathan of the skies, she was 804 feet from stem to stern, longer than any of the world's battleships. With a gas capacity of just over 7 million cubic feet, Hindenburg was the largest aircraft that had ever flown. She had been built as an airborne liner to ply the Atlantic route to the United States. Her 72 passengers flew in spacious luxury, housed inside the Hindenburg's massive Duralumin hull. They enjoyed elegant meals and relaxed in the saloon, where they were entertained by a special lightweight grand piano, built of aluminium and weighing just 360 pounds. The huge slanting viewing windows were protected from the elements by the Hindenburg's hull and gave a panoramic view of the scene sliding by below. Airmail carried a special Hindenburg stamp. The Hindenburg's galley was all electric with no open flames. Her smoking saloon was sealed off from the rest of the airship. Only electric lighters were allowed on board. Fire was feared by all who designed and flew airships, lifted by millions of cubic feet of highly inflammable hydrogen. The smallest spark could spell disaster. But the Hindenburg seemed as safe as houses. In 1936, she represented the future of long-distance air transport. Cruising at 80 miles per hour, she could cross the Atlantic in just 2 days, half the time of a blue-ribboned liner. Her four diesel engines gave Hindenburg a range of 8,500 miles. Total confidence reigned on the flight deck. It was soon to be shattered. What should have been just another transatlantic crossing ended in the most spectacular disaster in aviation history. The greatest airship of them all was herself destroyed by fire in circumstances which have never been fully explained. Mystery still surrounds the last flight of the Hindenburg. The airship era lasted barely 50 years. Semi-rigid airships, like this Santos Dumont machine of the 1890s, paved their way. The father of the rigid airship was a German, Count Ferdinand von Zeppelin. His first rigid airship, LZ-1, took to the skies in July 1900. This is his fourth, LZ-4, which in July 1906 made a famous 12-hour flight from Germany to Switzerland. Overnight, Count von Zeppelin became a world celebrity. The airships he designed became known as Zeppelins. Three years later, the Count formed DILAG, the German Airship Transport Company, the world's first commercial airline. Between 1910 and 1914, DILAG carried nearly 40,000 paying customers to every corner of Germany. Zeppelin was now dreaming of airships which would circle the globe. For the moment, DILAG's horizons were more modest. In conditions which would not have disgraced a first-class railway carriage, passengers enjoy a flight in Schwaben, Zeppelin's first successful commercial airship. In spite of their size, Zeppelin's airships were fragile and accident-prone. The men who flew them had to master modern technology and the ancient elements of wind and weather. Commanding a Zeppelin was likened to skippering a T-clipper in the great days of sail. Zeppelin's airmen were equal to the task. There were accidents in DILAG's first 4 years, but not a single life was lost. Germany led the world in airship design. In August 1914, German airships went to war. They cruised on reconnaissance flights over France, Russia, and the North Sea. In 1915, they launched a bombing campaign against Britain. They caused little damage, but the bombs they dropped opened a new era of aerial warfare. Many of the Zeppelins were brought down by bad weather or incendiary bullets fired by British night fighters. The Zeppelins were not war winners, but when peace came, their great range opened the way to long-distance transoceanic flights. The first transatlantic round trip, the key to a commercial future, was made by a British airship, R-34. One of her crew parachuted onto American soil to the delight of onlookers after a record-breaking flight which lasted just over 109 hours. As R-34 descended, discharging water ballast to slow her descent, the future of the airship seemed assured. But the high hopes held out for the airship were constantly dashed by disaster. In August 1921, the new British airship, R-38, which was on trials for the US Navy, broke in half and plunged into the Humber estuary, killing 44 of her crew. Undeterred, the US Navy dispensed with British help and built its own airships. The most ambitious were the Macon and Akron. Both were lifted by helium, a gas which would not burn, but which was many times more expensive than hydrogen. The formidable reconnaissance range of these airships was increased by turning them into flying aircraft carriers. In their bellies, they carried four Curtiss Sparrowhawk aircraft. The little biplanes were retrieved by a trapeze lowered from the airship, a difficult maneuver to master. The role of the ground crew was often equally dangerous. These three men were yanked into the air by Akron on the end of a landing line. Two fell to their deaths. The third survived by clinging to the line for over 2 hours. Macon and Akron both perished in accidents. After Macon went down off the Californian coast in February 1935, the American military airship program was cancelled. The British had also pressed on with a new program of airship construction. During the 1920s, it was decided to hold a competition. Two airships would be built. One, the R-100, by a subsidiary of the Vickers Company. The other, R-101, by the government's own Royal Airship Works at Cardington. It was a classic contest between private enterprise and state funding, and it led to a major disaster. There were not enough top-flight British airship designers and engineers to support two projects. Most of the talent was concentrated at Vickers. Its team was led by the brilliant Barnes Wallis, who later designed the Dambuster's famous bouncing bomb in the Second World War. In the summer of 1930, R-100 made a successful double crossing of the Atlantic. Things were not going so well at Cardington. The plan was to use R-101 to open up an imperial air route to India. She was to fly to the subcontinent and back in October 1930, arriving in London at the start of a conference at which the premiers of all Britain's dominions would be gathered. But the R-101 had been plagued by teething troubles. They had been so serious that at the last minute she had been cut in half and 45 feet of extra gas bag added to her midriff. Her outer cover was rotting. R-101 had not been flown on a single high-speed or bad-weather test. She was underpowered and overloaded with fuel. She was a disaster waiting to happen. The airship experts advised against flying. The politicians plowed on. R-101 was loaded for departure. She was further weighed down by a huge red carpet, ready to be rolled out for a VIP dinner aboard her when she touched down in Egypt. A final conference was held at the Air Ministry on the 2nd of October. Lord Thompson of Cardington, the man who had dreamed up the idea of the airship competition, wanted to leave the next day. Eventually, takeoff was agreed for the evening of the 4th of October. The Director of Civil Aviation, Air Vice Marshal Sir Sefton Branker, voiced his doubts. He knew of R-101's inherent weaknesses. Thompson told him, "If you are afraid, then do not go." Sefton Branker went. At 8 p.m. that night, the great airship flew over London. Rain and strong headwinds were forecast over France. In foul weather and weighed down by tons of water sloshing around in her cover, R-101 crashed into a hillside near Beauvais in northern France. Lord Thompson was burnt to death in his bunk. There were only 6 survivors. After the funeral, the perfectly sound R-100 was scrapped. And along with it, Britain's airship program. Meanwhile, the Germans were back in the airship business. Hugo Eckener, Zeppelin's successor, led the way. After the First World War, Germany had been forbidden to operate any new airships. But an airship program began again in 1926. Its first result was the Graf Zeppelin. She made her maiden flight in September 1926. It was the prelude to 9 uninterrupted years of service in which Graf Zeppelin flew over 1 million miles. In 1929, Graf Zeppelin made a record-breaking round-the-world flight. She cruised majestically over Siberia and then across the Pacific. It seemed that only the Germans had the know-how to make the airship dream a reality. In 1936, they unveiled the 129th Zeppelin, the Hindenburg. Most of the money to build her had been provided by Adolf Hitler's Nazi government. Hugo Eckener had wanted to lift her with helium, but the United States was the only producer of this non-inflammable gas. The US government refused to export helium if it was to be used for potentially military purposes. The Hindenburg would have to be lifted with highly inflammable hydrogen. Eckener was not unduly worried. He considered that there was a greater fire risk from the petroleum in the engines than a leak from one of Hindenburg's huge gas cells. Having paid for Hindenburg, the Nazis exacted their pound of flesh. In 1936, there was a referendum in Germany over Hitler's occupation of the Rhineland. Graf Zeppelin and Hindenburg were commandeered by Joseph Goebbels' propaganda ministry. The Zeppelins crisscrossed the country, showering the population with leaflets and bombarding them with broadcasts. Hugo Eckener, who had nothing but contempt for the Nazis, made no secret of his opposition to the use of the airships as propaganda tools for Hitler. At a voting booth aboard the spanking new Hindenburg, 104 votes were cast for the German leader, none against. But there were those in Germany who were opposed to Hitler's policies of brutal racism and growing militarism. Their groups were small, scattered, and uncoordinated. They watched with growing concern as Hitler tightened his grip. If banned books could be burned by the Nazis, then why not the hydrogen-filled Hindenburg? Hindenburg's first season was a resounding success. A sister airship was under construction and looked set to be completed by September 1937. Even bigger airships were in the pipeline. There seemed to be only one threat on the horizon: a rival transatlantic service provided by American flying boats to the west coast of Ireland. But these aircraft could not offer the luxury travel which was the hallmark of the Hindenburg. Hindenburg sailed serenely on. In Washington, the Germans hit back by laying on special VIP flights for politicians, industrialists, and bankers. Special airmail was delivered, and passengers expressed their satisfaction at the flight.
I enjoyed the trip tremendously. It was a real revelation.
We've had a lovely time ever since we left Frankfurt. I only wish we could do it all over again.
On the 3rd of May, 1937, Hindenburg emerged from her hangar in Frankfurt for her first transatlantic flight of the new season. Her destination was the airfield at Lakehurst, New Jersey. For some time, the Zeppelin company had been receiving letters from anti-Nazi groups threatening to sabotage the Hindenburg if she continued to fly to America. Some of the letters had been handed over to the American authorities by the German embassy in Washington. There is little evidence that the Zeppelin company took the threat seriously. After all, commercial Zeppelins had been flying since 1900 without losing a single passenger. The flight went ahead. This time, however, the passenger list was not full, only 36 out of a possible 72. But the return flight was fully booked. The crossing to America was uneventful. Visibility was poor, and passengers spent much of their time relaxing in the bar, dozing, or discussing the political situation in Germany. The Hindenburg glided over ice floes and then icebergs. At least one passenger was reminded of the fate which had befallen the Titanic. Landfall was made over Long Island Sound. Over New York, Hindenburg descended low enough for passengers to spot news photographers on their vantage point at the top of the Empire State Building. The landing at Lakehurst Airfield had been scheduled for 4 o'clock in the afternoon, but there was a delay. Dark rain clouds were massing over Lakehurst. Hindenburg's skipper, Captain Pruss, decided to turn back towards the coast to wait for the anticipated thunderstorm to move away. At 6:30, tea and sandwiches were served on the Hindenburg while it cruised over the deserted beaches of the New Jersey coastline. Passengers idled away the time, gazing out of the windows at the forests of New Jersey below. The weather at Lakehurst cleared, and Captain Pruss commenced his landing approach. At 7:10, Hindenburg appeared over Lakehurst. Down below, passengers for the return flight filed into the departure lounge. Cameramen clung to the roof to record the landing, and newsmen prepared to file their copy. Hindenburg approached the mooring mast. Jettisoning ballast to slow her descent, she came down to 200 feet and prepared to drop her landing lines to the ground. It seemed like a routine landing. Passengers craned their necks for a view from the windows. Soon they would be setting foot in America. As the Hindenburg steel mooring cable emerged from her nose, a light rain began to fall. The landing lines went down. Then disaster struck. Radio reporter Herb Morrison had a ringside seat.
He burst into flames. Wait, get this started. It's frightening, terrible. Oh, my, get out of the way, please. It's burning, bursting into flames, and it's falling on the mooring fast. And all the folks agree that this is terrible. This is one of the worst catastrophes in the world. Oh, it's funny. Oh, 400 or 500 feet into the sky, and it's a terrific crash, ladies and gentlemen. The smoke and the flames now, and the flame is rising to the ground, not quite to the mooring mast. All the humanity and all the fans screaming around me. I can't even talk to people whose friends are out there. I can't talk, ladies and gentlemen.
Observers had reported a small jet of flame near the upper fin. Within seconds, Hindenburg was transformed into a giant torch. It had taken just 32 seconds from the appearance of the first flame to Hindenburg's final collapse into a mass of twisted metal and blazing wreckage. 36 people died in the inferno. 22 crewmen, 13 passengers, and one member of the ground crew. Astonishingly, 61 people jumped, crawled, or were pulled from the flames alive. One of the survivors was the acrobat, Joseph Spahr.
The only thing I can do say that, I don't know, it all happened so fast. There isn't much to figure about. I do think that I'm very lucky that I'm sitting home here in my own home again after this experience this afternoon. And as I said before, I'm just happy.
What had happened to the Hindenburg? One moment a monarch of the skies, the next a blackened outline in a New Jersey field. The U.S. Department of Commerce launched an inquiry. The man in charge at Lakehurst, Commander Rosendahl, testified that he had seen a small mushroom-shaped flame forward of the rudder fin just before the explosion. After 18 days of testimony, the Department of Commerce invited Hugo Eckner, the grand old man of airships, to deliver his verdict. Eckner's verdict was highly speculative. He concluded that as the Hindenburg turned sharply towards the mooring mast, a bracing wire may have snapped in her stern, breaching a gas bag. The escaping gas was then ignited by static electricity when the landing ropes touched the ground in the highly charged atmosphere after the storm at Lakehurst. Tests to confirm this were inconclusive. Nevertheless, an investigation by the German government reached the same conclusion. This left many niggling doubts about the fate of the Hindenburg. How could the static electricity have traveled so quickly up the landing ropes? The small jet of flame seen by Rosendahl had not been captured on any of the newsreel footage of the disaster. The Hindenburg skipper, Captain Max Pruss, had a simpler theory. He believed that the Hindenburg had been sabotaged. At the inquiry, Pruss had been gagged by Josef Goebbels. The Nazi propaganda chief was determined to slam the lid down on any suggestion that someone could destroy one of the most visible international symbols of the Third Reich. It was not until the Third Reich itself was destroyed that Eckner's verdict was challenged. After the war, two crewmen came forward to claim that they had seen the flame which had sealed Hindenburg's fate. It was not at the top of the ship, as Rosendahl had testified and Eckner had assumed. It was inside, just where a gas bag was pierced by the main central gangway and less than 50 feet from the crewmen's landing stations near the lower fin. The men said that they had heard a sudden pop over their heads. They looked up to see a circle of bright light some 3 feet in diameter. They said it resembled a flashbulb igniting. Had a simple photographic timer set off the flashbulb, which was itself capable of igniting Hindenburg's hydrogen? And if so, who had planted the tiny device which had caused such devastation? Suspicion focused on a member of Hindenburg's crew, a rigger named Erich Speil. Speil was a keen amateur photographer and was also rumored to have anti-Nazi views. He was one of only three crewmen who normally used the axial gangway. He had the ability, opportunity, and perhaps the motive to plant a bomb. It is unlikely that Speil would have committed suicide by timing his flashbulb bomb to go off while the Hindenburg was still in the air. So the theory goes that it was time to explode after the Hindenburg had landed. But the delay caused by the storm at Lakehurst had disrupted Speil's plan, and he was unable to return from his landing station in the bow to reset it. Was the Hindenburg the victim of sabotage or an accident unique in the annals of rigid airships? We shall never know. The anti-Nazi rigger died in the disaster, and Hugo Eckner's explanation amounted to no more than a theory. The death of the Hindenburg remains an unfinished story.
Well, folks, that was the Hindenburg disaster, which occurred in 1937 and came from the Myths and Legends documentary series. Just note, though, friends, that I'm not giving title names or chapter names or anything like that, because it just makes it a lot easier to tell you the name of or subject of the particular episode. All right, here is our next episode. The Titanic disaster, which occurred in 1912. So let's hear the Titanic disaster now. Thank you.
On the 15th of April, 1912, the ocean liner Titanic sank on the fifth day of her maiden voyage. 1,523 passengers and crew died in the disaster. Over 70 years after the Titanic went down, research ships gathered over her resting place 2.5 miles below the icy waters of the North Atlantic. Robot submarines were lowered into the water to probe the secrets of the most famous shipwreck of them all. In Halifax, Nova Scotia, a graveyard contains the bodies recovered from the sea after Titanic sank. They met their deaths in the mightiest ship of the day, the largest man-made moving object which had ever been built. The Titanic had been dubbed unsinkable by the press, and the safety features she incorporated were the most advanced in the world. But like an Atlantic fog, mystery still shrouds the fate which overtook Titanic on that freezing night in 1912. How was it that the unsinkable ship could go down so swiftly and with so great a loss of life? The Titanic was the pride of the British White Star Line. She was 882 feet long, displaced 66,000 tons, and could carry 2,230 passengers. But she was not unique. She had a sister ship, the Olympic, from which she was virtually indistinguishable. Both liners were built in Belfast at the Harland and Wolff shipyard. Olympic was the first of the two ships to slide down the slipway on the 20th of October 1910. Her passage into the water eased by 23 tons of grease. 6 months later, on the 31st of May 1911, as Olympic was being readied for her maiden voyage, Titanic was launched. Within minutes, she was floating gracefully in the River Lagan before being towed to her berth for fitting out. The VIPs who gathered that day included the American magnate John Pierpont Morgan. White Star might be a British company, but its ultimate owner was Morgan through his International Mercantile Marine Company. It was a time when the transatlantic passenger trade was booming. The only way to cross the Atlantic was by ship. The White Star Line was locked in a cutthroat competition with the Cunard Line for the lion's share of the transatlantic trade. Cunard's two 30,000-tonners, Mauritania and Lusitania, were certainly faster. Mauritania held the blue ribbon for the fastest crossing of the Atlantic from 1907 to 1929. But Olympic and Titanic were bigger and could carry many more passengers. And those who sailed first class enjoyed the last word in ocean-going luxury. The great liners, and in particular White Star's great ships, were like huge floating hotels. The magazine Engineer reported that Titanic had been built for comfort rather than speed. The safety of the Titanic was, in theory at least, guaranteed by a system of 15 watertight bulkheads. These were of varying heights, but all of them rose to at least 2.5 feet above the waterline. Titanic was designed to stay afloat if any two of the 16 transverse compartments formed by the bulkheads were flooded. Shipbuilder magazine called Titanic practically unsinkable. Less cautious journalists dispense with the niggling qualification. She was unsinkable. If the impossible did happen, there were only 20 lifeboats on Titanic, capable of carrying less than half of the maximum complement of passengers and crew. This was perfectly in accord with the regulations, which had not been updated since 1894, and were based on a ship's tonnage, not the number of passengers and crew she carried. White Star was an accident-prone shipping line. On the 20th of September, 1911, less than 4 months after her maiden transatlantic voyage, Titanic's sister ship Olympic was involved in a serious collision in Southampton water with HMS Hawke, one of the Royal Navy's armored cruisers. The cruiser's ram tore two great gashes in Olympic's stern and badly damaged her propellers and crankshaft. The wounded Leviathan had to return to Belfast for repairs. They were to take nearly 7 weeks and cost White Star £250,000, one-sixth of the liner's original building costs. No sooner was Olympic back at sea than she ran over a wreck and lost a propeller blade. Back to Belfast she went for more repairs. On the 2nd of April, 1912, after successful sea trials, Titanic left Belfast for Southampton to take on passengers for her maiden transatlantic crossing. The stores she picked up included 20,000 bottles of beer, 1,500 bottles of wine, 32 tons of fresh meat, 40 tons of potatoes, 800 bundles of fresh asparagus, and 8,000 cigars. No one aboard Titanic would go hungry on her maiden voyage, and her saloons and bars would be blue with tobacco smoke. But she was not carrying a full complement of passengers. Fewer than 1,000 boarded at Southampton, 427 of them in first and second class, and 495 in third class. Nevertheless, Titanic's designer, Thomas Andrews, aboard for the voyage, wrote to his wife, "The Titanic is now about complete, and will, I think, do the old firm credit when we sail tomorrow." There were still many notables on the Titanic as she steamed out of Southampton. But one important absentee was J.P. Morgan, who had cancelled at the last minute, pleading ill health. The first stop was to be Cherbourg, in northern France, where another 244 passengers would come on board. 20 fortunate cross-channel passengers would go ashore. Among the first-class passengers were a number of people of immense wealth. Colonel John Jacob Astor, said to be worth $30 million, over $1 billion in today's money. Benjamin Guggenheim, another member of a fabulously rich immigrant American dynasty. And Isidore Strauss, the owner of Macy's department store in New York. Taking a free ride in one of Titanic's millionaire suites was Joseph Bruce Ismay, the British chief executive of the White Star Line. Traveling more modestly were the third-class passengers, mostly emigrants on their way to start a new life in America. One fact that none of Titanic's passengers were aware of was that deep in the bowels of the ship, a coal fire was burning in one of her bunkers. It had started several days before, but had not been drawn to the attention of the inspectors who boarded the liner at Southampton. Bestriding the bridge of the Titanic was the reassuringly bewhiskered figure of Captain Edward John Smith, the White Star Line's senior, and at £1,250 a year, the highest-paid seaman in the world. It was his job to command all White Star's new liners on their maiden voyages. He planned to retire after this trip. Smith radiated confidence and command, but he had been on Olympic's bridge when she was rammed by HMS Hawke. He was also there when Olympic hit the wreck. And, as Titanic left Southampton, the speed at which Smith took her out caused the liner New York to spring her moorings. A collision was narrowly avoided. After picking up passengers and mail in Cherbourg, Titanic sailed to Queenstown on the southwest coast of Ireland. There she took on more passengers and 1,400 sacks of mail. Then she weighed anchor at 1:30 p.m. on the 11th of April, and steamed majestically out into the Atlantic. On the orders of Joseph Bruce Ismay, Smith now accelerated into an area of the Atlantic where there was a gathering ice threat. The winter had been the mildest for years. Numerous icebergs had broken away from the polar ice caps and drifted with the Labrador Current into the Atlantic. To avoid the ice, White Star had charted a southerly course for Titanic. Under normal conditions, this should have kept her well away from any ice fields. But the ice had moved farther south than Captain Smith had anticipated. Nevertheless, it seems that Joseph Bruce Ismay was determined that Titanic should beat her sister ship Olympic's best time for the Atlantic. At gathering speed, Titanic was sailing straight into danger. On Sunday the 14th of April, as Titanic crossed the Grand Banks, she received the first of six clear ice warnings. The second warning from the White Star liner Baltic was pocketed by Ismay and not posted in Titanic's chart room for several hours. Oblivious of this, the passengers had settled into the routines of shipboard life. Even those in second class had cabins the equal of other lines' first-class accommodation. While first-class passengers promenaded up and down the impressive main staircase and enjoyed the splendor of the first-class dining room, where the hum of conversation drowned the distant throb of Titanic's mighty engines. That fifth night of the voyage, filet mignon, roast duckling, and sirloin of beef were on the menu. By that time, Titanic was moving well into the danger zone. The last ice warning came by signal lamp at 10:30 p.m. from SS Rappahannock. Have just passed through heavy ice and several icebergs. The message was acknowledged by lamp from Titanic's bridge and could have left no doubt that she was now in a major ice field. Yet her speed was maintained. Up in Titanic's crow's nest, Seaman Frederick Fleet was straining his eyes for ice. There were plenty of binoculars available for the task, but he did not have any in his freezing perch. The sky was bright with stars, and the sea like a millpond. The absence of wind made it more difficult to spot an iceberg, since there were no breaking waves, which would have been quickly spotted by lookouts. As it was, Fleet had no time. At 11:40 p.m., he saw a huge mass dead ahead. His warning bell, which caused the liner to swing to port, told the end for Titanic. 40 seconds and 500 yards later, she struck the iceberg a glancing blow. Quantities of ice cascaded onto Well-Deck C between Titanic's bridge and forecastle. On the bridge, Second Officer Charles Lightoller felt a slight shock, a slight trembling, and a grinding sound. It took the iceberg, reeking of rotting fish, just 10 seconds to open Titanic up like a sardine can. The Titanic's designer, Thomas Andrews, went below with Captain Smith to inspect the damage. Five of Titanic's watertight compartments were flooded, and water soon spilled over into a sixth. "How long have we got?" Smith asked. Andrews replied, "An hour and a half, possibly two. Not much longer." Strangely, it took another 15 minutes before Titanic's powerful Marconi wireless telegraphy apparatus sent out the first in a long series of distress signals. Another 25 minutes passed before an order was given to prepare the lifeboats, and it was not until 12:55 a.m. that the first was launched. When it became clear to Benjamin Guggenheim that Titanic could not be saved, he went to his cabin and, with his valet, donned full evening dress to die like a gentleman. Although the orders were women and children first, Isidore Strauss's wife Ida refused to leave her husband, declaring, "As we have lived, so we will die, together." John Jacob Astor bade goodbye to his pregnant wife and stepped back to await death. The tragedy of the Titanic was compounded by the fact that the crew mistakenly believed that the lifeboats could not be lowered fully loaded. Only the last few boats to leave the ship were crowded. Many left half empty, while officers armed with pistols held passengers back. It was an incredible scene. Distress rockets burst over the brightly lit ship. Through the roars of steam released to prevent the boilers exploding came the strains of the ship's orchestra, running through its repertoire from ragtime to religious music. At 1:55 a.m., the last lifeboat slipped away into the ice field. The band struck up, "Nearer, My God, to Thee." 1,500 passengers and crew, nearly all men, were left behind. But not Joseph Bruce Ismay, who had stepped into a lifeboat after his wife. At about 2:20 a.m., Titanic began her death throes. She had been sinking steadily by the bow, but now she began to plunge more steeply, sending the hundreds left on board towards the stern. A funnel broke free and crashed into the water, crushing scores of people swimming desperately for survival. There was a series of deafening explosions as her boilers broke free and crashed through her. Her lights, kept going by the heroic efforts of the ship's engineers, finally flickered out. The air trapped in her stern kept her afloat for a last few minutes. Then she was gone, and all was silence. At least 16 ships had heard Titanic's distress calls, one of which was the very first SOS signal in maritime history. But only one ship, the Cunard liner Carpathia, arrived on the scene with sufficient speed to make a difference. Her captain, Edward Rostron, made 24 knots through the ice to Titanic's reported position, clearing his ship's decks for action and firing rockets from her bows to signal his approach. Rostron plucked 705 numb and shivering survivors from the lifeboats and made for New York. News that Titanic was in trouble had reached the press in New York in the small hours of the 15th of April. But the full story was not known until Carpathia arrived on the evening of the 18th of April. The newsmen were waiting for the survivors, checkbooks in hand. Ghouls were about, too. When Carpathia lowered Titanic's lifeboats, they were stripped that night for souvenirs. Later, Titanic's name was sanded off. The press swarmed over the crew who had manned the lifeboats. In the shocked aftermath, there was many a tale to tell. Among them, reports that a well-lit ship had passed within sight of the Titanic but failed to heed her signals. Titanic's crew had to rely on charity. Their pay ceased when the ship went down. Captain Rostron was the hero of the hour. In Britain, the press was already picking up the themes of Titanic's high speed and lack of lifeboats. Ships were now searching for bodies in the area where Titanic went down. The Mackay Bennett, which set sail from Halifax on the 22nd of April, picked up 190 bodies and buried 116 of them at sea. In London, a memorial service for the dead was held at St. Paul's Cathedral. There was such a crush that thousands filled the streets outside. Two inquiries, American and British, followed the disaster. The Americans were at pains to fix the blame for the deaths of so many of their fellow countrymen on British incompetence. The British inquiry was marked by frequent muddles between Titanic and Olympic and arguments about where exactly Titanic went down. It also investigated the phenomenon of the so-called mystery ship, which had been reported close by, but which was never identified. Some have doubted its existence, but not survivors like Eva Hart, who escaped from the Titanic with her mother. Her father went down with the ship.
I am bitter. Against whichever ship it was, there was a ship close enough to have come to our rescue, and it didn't.
But another scapegoat was at hand. Captain Lord of the California had ordered his ship to heave to about 20 miles to the northeast of Titanic. His radio was switched off, and Lord was asleep. But his officers did see Titanic's distress rockets. But this was only 50 minutes before Titanic sank, too late for California to steam to the rescue. Nevertheless, to the end of his days, Lord bore much of the blame for loss of life. Nor did Joseph Bruce Ismay escape unscathed. No one believed his bluster that he was just an ordinary passenger on Titanic. Ismay was to claim that he had undergone an early version of trial by newspaper. But did his very presence aboard encourage Smith recklessly to maintain his speed and ignore clear warnings that he was standing into danger? Curiously, Titanic's log went down with her. Was this simply the result of confusion, or was it a deliberate attempt to lose the evidence of Joseph Bruce Ismay's orders to Captain Smith? Had Titanic been sailing more slowly, she might have been able to avoid the iceberg. Even if she had hit the berg head-on, Titanic would not have sunk. But the gash in her side was at a point where Titanic's plates of mild steel had been made brittle by the freezing water. 3 million rivets had been designed into her. At that fatal moment, many of those below the waterline were sprung. But what if it was not Titanic that was taken by the sea? In recent years, an ingenious theory suggested that Titanic and Olympic had been switched when Olympic came in for her second round of repairs at Belfast in March 1912. Perhaps the loss-making Olympic had been crippled by her two collisions. Titanic, nearing completion, was virtually identical. Why not switch them, and then write off Olympic in the North Atlantic in a crowded sea lane where the rescue of passengers and crew could be counted on? At the British inquiry after the trial, were the inspectors unwittingly examining Titanic rather than Olympic? If switched there had been, it would have been one of the biggest insurance frauds of all time. J.P. Morgan was a man of sufficient ruthlessness to have sanctioned such a desperate measure. He cancelled his trip on Titanic on the grounds of ill health. A few days after she sank, Morgan was found, apparently healthy and happy, at a French spa with his mistress. But the ingenious switch theory was exploded in 1994, when items salvaged from the wreck of Titanic were examined. The Titanic had a hull number, 401, which was stamped on all its major parts. When the helm indicator from the stern bridge was recovered alongside more everyday objects, it bore the number 401 stamped into its bronze stand. There could be no doubt that it was the Titanic which lay on the seabed, surrounded by the poignant debris of the disaster. Many of the victims lie elsewhere, their graves asking the question, how had the unsinkable Titanic, the greatest ship of her day, come to grief? She had seemed like a triumph of engineering, a symbol of man's mastery of the physical world. But it was the physical world, in the form of an iceberg, which sank her, able to do so because of inherent faults in her design. The other causes were all too human. Captain Smith's reckless disregard of a series of danger signals, egged on by the equally reckless Joseph Bruce Ismay. Between them, they doomed the ship. And it was the spurious legend of her unsinkability that doomed many of Titanic's passengers. They delayed clambering into the lifeboats, little realizing the peril they were in. When they did, it was too late.
Well, folks, that was the Titanic disaster, which came from a Myths and Legends series. I have two extra files to play for you, which will give you more historical information plus eyewitness accounting about the Titanic disaster. Our first clip comes from Charles Light Oliver, and he discusses about the sinking of the Titanic, and it's 1 minute long. So let's hear it now.
Next thing I remember, I was still hanging on to a bit of rope attached to the raft, but some 30 or 40 yards away from the ship. The wash of the falling funnel had evidently picked us up, raft and all, and flung us clear of the ship altogether. Several of us scrambled up onto the slippery bottom of the raft, and it was from there I saw the Titanic sink. As I watched, I could see her bow getting deeper and deeper in the water, with the foremast sticking up above the surface, whilst her stern lifted higher and higher, till it was right out of the water. When she got to an angle of about 60 degrees, there was a sullen sort of rumbling roar, as her massive boilers all left their beds and went crashing down through the bulk's heads and everything that stood in their way. Up to that moment, she had stood out as clear with her rows of electric lights all burning. When the boilers broke away, she was, of course, plunged into absolute darkness. Though her huge black outline was still perfectly distinct up against the stars and sky. Slowly she reared up on end, till at last she was absolutely perpendicular. Then, quite quietly, but quicker and quicker, she seemed just to slide away under the surface and disappear. As she vanished, everyone round me on the upturned boat, as though they could hardly believe it, just said, "She's gone."
Well, folks, that was a 1 minute excerpt from Charles Light Oliver about the sinking of the Titanic, which occurred in 1912. For your information, this clip came from the American History Through the Eyes of Radio, which is a big collaboration of a bunch of different episodes showing America's history, and was produced by the Old Time Radio Researchers Group. I should say it was put together by the Old Time Radio Researchers Group rather than produced. Now, friends, let's hear our last file for tonight. It's an 18-minute production, an 18-minute reading. This comes from the LibriVox.org catalog. Here is Thrilling Story by a Surviving Titanic Wireless Man. Let's enjoy this account.
Thrilling Story by Titanic's Surviving Wireless Man by Harold Bride. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Thrilling Story by Titanic's Surviving Wireless Man. Bride tells how he and Phillips worked and how he finished a stoker who tried to steal Phillips' life belt. Ship sank to tune of Autumn. By Harold Bride, surviving wireless operator of the Titanic. This statement was dictated by Mr. Bride to a reporter for the New York Times who visited him with Mr. Marconi in the wireless cabin of the Carpathia a few minutes after the steamship touched her pier. In the first place, the public should not blame anybody because more wireless messages about the disaster to the Titanic did not reach shore from the Carpathia. I positively refused to send press dispatches because the bulk of personal messages with touching words of grief was so large. The wireless operators aboard the Chester got all they asked for, and they were wretched operators. They knew American Morse, but not Continental Morse sufficiently to be worthwhile. They taxed our endurance to the limit. I had to cut them out at last. They were so insufferably slow, and go ahead with our messages of grief to relatives. We sent 119 personal messages today and 50 yesterday. When I was dragged aboard the Carpathia, I went to the hospital at first. I stayed there for 10 hours. Then somebody brought word that the Carpathia's wireless operator was getting queer from the work. They asked me if I could go up and help. I could not walk. Both my feet were broken or something. I don't know what. I went up on crutches with somebody helping me. I took the key, and I never left the wireless cabin after that. Our meals were brought to us. We kept the wireless working all the time. The Navy operators were a great nuisance. I advised them all to learn the Continental Morse and learn to speed it up if they ever expect to be worth their salt. The Chester's man thought he knew it, but he was as slow as Christmas coming. We worked all the time. Nothing went wrong. Sometimes the Carpathia man sent, and sometimes I sent. There was a bed in the wireless cabin. I could sit on it and rest my feet while sending sometimes. To begin at the beginning, I joined the Titanic at Belfast. I was born at Nunhead, England, 22 years ago, and joined the Marconi forces last July. I first worked on the Hoverford and then on a Lusitania. I joined the Titanic at Belfast. Asleep when crash came. I didn't have much to do aboard the Titanic except to relieve Phillips from midnight until sometime in the morning when he should be through sleeping. On the night of the accident, I was not sending, but was asleep. I was due to be up and relieve Phillips earlier than usual. And that reminds me, if it hadn't been for a lucky thing, we never could have sent any call for help. The lucky thing was that the wireless broke down early enough for us to fix it before the accident. We noticed something wrong on Sunday, and Phillips and I worked 7 hours to find it. We found a secretary burned out at last and repaired it just a few hours before the iceberg was struck. Phillips said to me as he took the night shift, "You turn in, boy, and get some sleep, and go up as soon as you can and give me a chance. I'm all done for with this work of making repairs." There were three rooms in the wireless cabin. One was a sleeping room, one a dynamo room, and one an operating room. I took off my clothes and went to sleep in bed. Then I was conscious of waking up and hearing Phillips sending to Cape Race. I read what he was sending. It was traffic matter. I remembered how tired he was, and I got out of bed without my clothes on to relieve him. I didn't even feel the shock. I hardly knew what had happened after the captain had come to us. There was no jolt whatever. I was standing by Phillips, telling him to go to bed, when the captain put his head in the cabin. "We've struck an iceberg," the captain said, "and I'm having an inspection made to tell what it has done for us. You'd better get ready to send out a call for assistance, but don't send it until I tell you." The captain went away, and in 10 minutes, I should estimate the time, he came back. We could hear a terrible confusion outside, but there was not the least thing to indicate that there was any trouble. The wireless was working perfectly. "Send the call for assistance," ordered the captain, barely putting his head in the door. "What call should I send?" Phillips asked. "The regulation international call for help. Just that." Then the captain was gone. Phillips began to send CQD. He flashed away at it, and we joked while he did so. All of us made light of the disaster. Joked at distress call. We joked that way while he flashed signals for about 5 minutes. Then the captain came back. "What are you sending?" he asked. "CQD," Phillips replied. The humor of the situation appealed to me. I cut in with a little remark that made us all laugh, including the captain. "Send SOS," I said. "It's the new call, and it may be your last chance to send it." Phillips, with a laugh, changed the signal to SOS. The captain told us we had been struck amidships, or just back of amidships. It was 10 minutes, Phillips told me, after he had noticed the iceberg, that the slight jolt that was the collision's only signal to us occurred. We thought we were a good distance away. We said lots of funny things to each other in the next few minutes. We picked up first the steamship Frankfurt. We gave her our position and said we had struck an iceberg and needed assistance. The Frankfurt operator went away to tell his captain. He came back, and we told him we were sinking by the head. By that time, we could observe a distinct list forward. The Carpathia answered our signal. We told her our position and said we were sinking by the head. The operator went to tell the captain, and in 5 minutes returned and told us that the captain of the Carpathia was putting about and heading for us. Great scramble on deck. Our captain had left us at this time, and Phillips told me to run and tell him what the Carpathia had answered. I did so, and I went through an awful mass of people to his cabin. The decks were full of scrambling men and women. I saw no fighting, but I heard tell of it. I came back and heard Phillips giving the Carpathia fuller directions. Phillips told me to put on my clothes. Until that moment, I forgot that I was not dressed. I went to my cabin and dressed. I brought an overcoat to Phillips. It was very cold. I slipped the overcoat upon him while he worked. Every few minutes, Phillips would send me to the captain with little messages. They were merely telling how the Carpathia was coming our way and gave her speed. I noticed as I came back from one trip that they were putting off women and children in lifeboats. I noticed that the list forward was increasing. Phillips told me that the wireless was growing weaker. The captain came and told us that our engine rooms were taking water and that the dynamos might not last much longer. We sent that word to the Carpathia. I went out on deck and looked around. The water was pretty close up to the boat deck. There was a great scramble aft, and how poor Phillips worked through it, I don't know. He was a brave man. I learned to love him that night, and I suddenly felt for him a great reverence, to see him standing there, sticking to his work, while everybody else was raging about. I will never live to forget the work of Phillips for the last awful 15 minutes. I thought it was about time to look about and see if there was anything detached that would float. I remembered that every member of the crew had a special life belt and ought to know where it was. I remembered mine was under my bunk. I went and got it. Then I thought how cold the water was. I remembered I had some boots, and I put those on, and an extra jacket, and I put that on. I saw Phillips standing out there, still sending away, giving the Carpathia details of just how we were doing. We picked up the Olympic and told her we were sinking by the head and were about all down. As Phillips was sending the message, I strapped his life belt to his back. I had already put on his overcoat. I wondered if I could get him into his boots. He suggested with a sort of laugh that I look about and see if all the people were off in the boats, or if any boats were left, or how things were. The last boat left. I saw a collapsible boat near a funnel and went over to it. 12 men were trying to boost it down to the boat deck. They were having an awful time. It was the last boat left. I looked at it longingly a few minutes. Then I gave them a hand, and over she went. They all started to scramble in on the boat deck, and I walked back to Phillips. I said the last raft had gone. Then came the captain's voice. "Men, you have done your full duty. You can do no more. Abandon your cabin. Now it's every man for himself. You look out for yourselves. I release you. That's the way of it at this kind of a time. Every man for himself." I looked out. The boat deck was awash. Phillips clung on, sending and sending. He clung on for about 10 minutes, or maybe 15 minutes, after the captain had released him. The water was then coming into our cabin. While he worked, something happened I hate to tell about. I was back in my room getting Phillips's money for him, and as I looked out the door, I saw a stoker, or somebody from below decks, leaning over Phillips from behind. He was too busy to notice what the man was doing. The man was slipping the life belt off Phillips's back. He was a big man, too. As you can see, I am very small. I don't know what it was I got hold of. I remembered in a flash the way Phillips had clung on, how I had to fix that life belt in place because he was too busy to do it. I know that man from below decks had his own life belt and should have known where to get it. I suddenly felt a passion not to let that man die a decent sailor's death. I wished he might have stretched rope or walked a plank. I did my duty. I hope I finished him. I don't know. We left him on the cabin floor of the wireless room, and he was not moving. Band plays in ragtime. From aft came the tunes of the band. It was a ragtime tune. I don't know what. Then there was Autumn. Phillips ran aft, and that was the last I ever saw of him alive. I went to the place I had seen the collapsible boat on the boat deck, and to my surprise I saw the boat and the men still trying to push it off. I guess there wasn't a sailor in the crowd. They couldn't do it. I went up to them, and I was just lending a hand when a large wave came awash of the deck. The big wave carried the boat off. I had hold of an oarlock, and I went off with it. The next I knew, I was in the boat. But that was not all. I was in the boat, and the boat was upside down, and I was under it. And I remember realizing I was wet through, and that whatever happened, I must not breathe, for I was underwater. I knew I had to fight for it, and I did. How I got out from under the boat, I do not know, but I felt a breath of air at last. There were men all around me, hundreds of them. The sea was dotted with them, all depending on their life belts. I felt I simply had to get away from the ship. She was a beautiful sight then. Smoke and sparks were rushing out of her funnel. There must have been an explosion, but we had heard none. We only saw the big stream of sparks. The ship was gradually turning on her nose, just like the duck does that goes down for a dive. I had only one thing on my mind, to get away from the suction. The band was still playing. I guess all of the band went down. They were playing Autumn then. I swam with all my might. I suppose I was 150 feet away when the Titanic, on her nose, with her after quarter sticking straight up in the air, began to settle, slowly. Pulled into a boat. When at last the waves washed over her rudder, there wasn't the least bit of suction I could feel. She must have kept going just so slowly as she had been. I forgot to mention that, besides the Olympic and Carpathia, we spoke some German boat, I don't know which, and told them how we were. We also spoke the Baltic. I remembered those things as I began to figure what ships would be coming toward us. I felt, after a little while, like sinking. I was very cold. I saw a boat of some kind near me and put all my strength into an effort to swim to it. It was hard work. I was all done when a hand reached out from the boat and pulled me aboard. It was our same collapsible. The same crowd was on it. There was just room for me to roll on the edge. I lay there, not caring what happened. Somebody sat on my legs. They were wedged in between slats and were being wrenched. I had not the heart to ask the man to move. It was a terrible sight all around, men swimming and sinking. I lay where I was, letting the man wrench my feet out of shape. Others came near. Nobody gave them a hand. The bottom-up boat already had more men than it would hold, and it was sinking. At first, the larger waves splashed over my clothing. Then they began to splash over my head, and I had to breathe when I could. As we floated around on our capsized boat, and I kept straining my eyes for a ship's lights, somebody said, "Don't the rest of you think we ought to pray?" The man who made the suggestion asked what the religion of the others was. Each man called out his religion. One was a Catholic, one a Methodist, one a Presbyterian. It was decided the most appropriate prayer for all was the Lord's Prayer. We spoke it over in chorus with the man who first suggested that we pray as the leader. Some splendid people saved us. They had a right-side-up boat, and it was full to its capacity, yet they came to us and loaded us all into it. I saw some lights off in the distance, and knew a steamship was coming to our aid. I didn't care what happened. I just lay and gasped when I could and felt the pain in my feet. At last, the Carpathia was alongside, and the people were being taken up a rope ladder. Our boat drew near, and one by one the men were taken off of it. One dead on the raft. One man was dead. I passed him and went to the ladder, though my feet pained terribly. The dead man was Phillips. He had died on the raft from exposure and cold, I guess. He had been all in from work before the wreck came. He stood his ground until the crisis had passed, and then he had collapsed, I guess. But I hardly thought that then. I didn't think much of anything. I tried the rope ladder. My feet pained terribly, but I got to the top and felt hands reaching out to me. The next thing I knew, a woman was leaning over me in a cabin, and I felt her hand waving back my hair and rubbing my face. I felt somebody at my feet and felt the warmth of a jolt of liquor. Somebody got me under the arms. Then I was hustled down below to the hospital. That was early in the day, I guess. I lay in the hospital until near night, and they told me the Carpathia's wireless man was getting queer, and would I help. After that, I was never out of the wireless room, so I don't know what happened among the passengers. I saw nothing of Mrs. Astor or any of them. I just worked wireless. The splutter never died down. I knew it soothed the hurt and felt like a tie to the world of friends and home. How could I then take news queries? Sometimes I let a newspaper ask a question and get a long string of stuff asking for full particulars about everything. Whenever I started to take such a message, I thought of the poor people waiting for their messages to go, hoping for answers to them. I shut off the inquirers and sent my personal messages, and I feel I did the white thing. If the Chester had had a decent operator, I could have worked with him longer, but he got terribly on my nerves with his insufferable incompetence. I was still sending my personal messages when Mr. Marconi and the Times reporter arrived to ask that I prepare this statement. There were maybe 100 left. I would like to send them all, because I know I could rest easier if I knew all those messages had gone to the friends waiting for them. But an ambulance man is waiting with a stretcher, and I guess I have got to go with him. I hope my legs get better soon. The way the band kept playing was a noble thing. I heard it first when still we were working wireless, when there was a ragtime tune for us. And the last I saw of the band, when I was floating out in the sea with my life belt on, it was still on deck playing Autumn. How they ever did it, I cannot imagine. That, and the way Phillips kept sending after the captain told him his life was his own, and to look out for himself, are two things that stand out in my mind over all the rest. End of Thrilling Story by Titanic's Surviving Wireless Man by Harold Bride. Read by Winston Tharp.
That was Thrilling Story by a Surviving Titanic Wireless Man, which was presented on the LibriVox.org nonfiction collection. I hope you enjoyed the presentation tonight. And if you would like to hear more Myths and Legends documentaries, let me know and I will consider playing more episodes from that wonderful series. My friends, may you have yourselves a good weekend and enjoy the rest of your summer. And also, I want you to be aware of something important. Way more important than history is our marathon. Yeah, that's right, friends. Our August 27th marathon, which is held in the Fred Bertelsen Library room on Saturday, August 27th, 2016, starting at 12 p.m. Eastern, ending at 12 a.m. Eastern. 12 hours of old-time radio shows for your listening enjoyment. And I'll be there myself hosting an hour and a half of intrigue. So how about you come and not only enjoy my shows, perhaps, but definitely enjoy everyone else's shows because we have a lot of good hosts. Peace out, my friends, and see you soon. Now, let's give the mic up to Louise. Hey, Louise, what you got to say, dude?
Okay, Mad Max, thanks a lot. Great work as usual. Now it's time for me to take over so I can shut things down and wrap things up for this week's broadcast of Michael's Saturday Night Surprise. Yep, folks, we are at the end. Hope you enjoyed it and enjoyed the special edition show here tonight. As usual, if you have any questions, comments, complaints, or maybe even a request or two, please direct them via email to mikeameli@earthlink.net. That's MIKEAMELI@earthlink.net. We will soon be releasing the key and returning the room to you, the listening audience. Please do with it as you wish, for as long as you wish. Just remember, be nice to one another. On behalf of myself and the rest of the MSS crew, have a great night, a great weekend, and goodbye.